Just when you thought it was safe to take down your jack-o'-lantern, the spooky season returns. But not just any spookum, a genre-defining one. Because two horror fans, and the occasional special guest, refuse to let evil die tonight. Welcome to the Apocalypse Video Halloween Retrospective. I am your slightly less creepy narrator, David Snyder. Tonight, prepare to learn the shocking secret behind Michael's madness and why it took a six-pack of beer to reach this lame plot twist. It's Halloween 2.
I shot him in the heart! The man, he's not human!
Universal Pictures presents Halloween 2. More of the night he came home.
Who is it?
There was nothing within him, neither conscience nor reason, that wasn't even remotely human.
Some kind of a joke. I've been trick-or-treated to death tonight.
You don't know what death is.
There is no place to hide. He will always find you.
What's this?
It's a Celtic word. It means the Lord of the Dead.
Halloween 2. More of the night he came home.
Hello, and welcome to the next installment of the Apocalypse Video Halloween Retrospective, where Halloween, where Shocktober never dies. I'm your host, Dave. I'm joined again by Immortan Hoof.
Hello.
AKA Nick. I just want to throw that out there in case, like, I'll call you Nick in the episode and people will be like, I thought it was a Martin Hoof. Anyway.
You can call me whatever.
Halloween, I'll call you evil because that's what you are. Lieutenant is evil.
And I never die.
Halloween 2. As I mentioned in the Bride of Frankenstein episode, if you remember, direct sequel, and it seems like afterwards there was, I guess I wasn't explaining myself very well in that episode, but as far as like the people here at the store, there was some contention about that. We were like, what do you mean by direct sequel, Dave? What are you talking about? Like, everything's a direct sequel. When I said direct sequel, I meant like specifically like in this case where a sequel will take place like seconds after the previous movie. It's not like, you know, I feel like most of the time with sequels, it'll take place maybe like a year or two after the events of the previous movie. But a direct sequel is one that takes place literally seconds after the last movie ended. And in several instances, like a direct sequel will show you the end of the last movie and then it'll just resume like nothing happened.
Like Maniac Cop 2.
Like there was no... Say again?
Like Maniac Cop 2.
Yeah, to a degree, I guess. Although Maniac Cop 2, there's like, isn't some time has passed with that movie?
Yeah,
like,
I just meant that they showed the footage from the first.
Yeah, movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but that's always the thing that I've honestly, it's maybe it's like a low bar, but it's one thing I've always loved about this movie is that it shows you the end of the movie and then he gets shot. Loomis runs downstairs and he's gone, and then the movie just resumes. Like it almost like it's the same movie almost. You know what I mean?
What's going on out here?
Call the police. Tell the sheriff I shot him.
Who?
Tell him he's still on the loose.
Is this some kind of joke? I've been trick-or-treated to death tonight.
You don't know what death is.
Yeah, it's an interesting... I mean, now that you've clarified what you mean by direct sequel, it's just basically a direct continuation of the same exact story. It's almost like...
the same night.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like instead of a sequel linked by... only characters or place or world or whatever, it's the same chain of events, really.
It's still going. Yeah. I love the tagline for this movie on the poster. It's simply, more of the night he came home. So it's just more. it's like one step away from saying, like, Halloween again.
Too hollow to ween.
Yeah, it's like this movie. Now, don't get me wrong. I enjoy this movie quite a bit. And I think for the longest time, I probably would have said that Halloween 2 is the best Halloween sequel. But as we were watching it, like, it kind of occurred to me. I'm like, this really is more of the first movie. Like, the beats are kind of the same. Like, I feel like the general kind of, pacing is more kind of the same, like, as far as, like, when he kills people and then when stuff happens, when there's a moment when it ratchets up and it kind of goes off from there. Like, it's sort of similar. It's like the same runtime, I think, even. They're both about an hour and a half long. But I think the difference between this movie and the first Halloween is that, whereas in the first movie, you would have long, drawn-out scenes, but, like, it felt like it was tense and scary. In this movie, like, I feel like it kind of drags at times. It doesn't feel like it's not so much tension, but it feels like it's kind of dragging a little bit. Was that just me?
I don't think I would use the word drag, because they both kind of breeze by for me. But I think that the tension is definitely not as palpable or ramped up for me. It's almost like the movie also knows that we know about Michael now. It's like, it's less treating Michael as something new and scary, and almost like, okay, you know who Michael is now, you know, here's what he's doing. I don't know. It just feels like it's more about the kills, I think.
It's important to note, this came out 3 years after the first Halloween in 1981, which is a year after Friday the 13th came out. And so this came out, like, right in the heyday of slashers, of ripoffs of Halloween and Friday the 13th, where it's all about the gore, it's all about the kills. And you definitely feel that influence on this movie.
Yeah, I think, but I will say, I want to get this out of the way real quick, is, like, I almost, like, feel like, in terms of what this movie could be, it's pretty dang good. I mean, I feel like this may be, I don't know how many times I've seen this one, maybe at least two times now, maybe three, but I remember thinking this before, is, like, I'm surprised how much I like this one too.
Well, because I feel like the again, John Carpenter's not directing the movie, but, like, the DNA is there from the first movie. Like, you got the same guy shooting it, Dean Cundey. John Carpenter and Deborah Hill came back and wrote it again. And there is even a scene that John Carpenter does direct. It's the scene when you see that guy with the boombox in, like, the city square walking by, and on the radio they're talking about where they took Laurie Strode, and then he bumps into Michael, and that's when Michael finds out, oh, okay, she's in the hospital, I'm gonna go kill her now.
Yeah, so, but it's interesting you bring up John Carpenter, because there were a couple things going on in this movie that I was thinking about that felt so different. Now, there's one scene in particular that really stood out to me in Halloween 2, and that's when, obviously they're in the hospital, because that's one thing I like about this movie, actually, that it takes place pretty much primarily in the hospital. I think that's cool. But there's a scene where it's basically all red. And the lighting is the lens is saturated in red, and this feels very different than anything we saw in the first one. Not that John Carpenter's, like, opposed to color or anything, but the use of color really felt distinctive. And I was like, okay, it's cool but different. And I think that it's just, like, it definitely, that was a moment that for some reason jumped out at me, and I was like, okay, this is a different creator, this is a different director, or whatever. It just jumped out to me, and I thought that was interesting. And I think it's interesting to think too, because John Carpenter's not opposed to sequels. You know, he did Escape from New York and Escape from LA, so he's done something like that. So it's interesting to think what this movie would have done how it would have turned out had he been at the helm of this one. And that's not to take away anything from this movie, really, because I still liked it quite a bit, actually. But it is interesting to think about, you know, what it could have been.
Well, it also, like, yeah, this movie, like, I don't mean to say, like, this movie is, like, devoid of any sort of originality. I mean, I mean, it is, I would say it's a lesser movie than Halloween for sure, but it does do some interesting things. Like you mentioned that whole scene with like, where it's just bathed in red, like that red light. But also one thing I really like that this movie does is right in the beginning, like the introduction of Mr. Sandman, like when playing Mr. Sandman over the beginning and end credits, like that might be one of the first instances for me where like a movie took like what would ordinarily be like an innocent song and put it like they juxtaposed it to something completely opposite, you know what I mean, where they put it on something where you wouldn't expect that song to be. And it works, it's kind of interesting. Like when I hear Mr. Sandman, I think of two things. I think of Halloween 2, and then I think of Back to the Future. So like weirdly, like those two movies, like Halloween 2 and Back to the Future, like it allows that song to flip-flop. Like for me, like it could be a really creepy song, but it could also be like kind of a cheery, whimsical song. It's interesting. The power of movies and putting music to movies is interesting.
Well, I think it's worth noting that at least, so like we talked about in the last episode, I've seen the first three Halloween movies. All three of them have very distinctive like songs that are associated with them. And they're all very good. They use them all very well.
Well, speaking of the music, like this Halloween 2 is interesting because the first movie, I mean, there's some synth in there for sure. It's John Carpenter, but it's mostly just him on the piano. Whereas in Halloween 2, it is synth heavy, man. It is like synth 80s. For days. We're in the 80s now, and John Carpenter's going to play with his synths. Like, I got to imagine John Carpenter was happiest on making this particular movie while he was making the music specifically. Like, just playing around with synths and just like, and it's a good score. Like, I enjoy this score.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot to enjoy here. Another thing, like I was saying, is the hospital. You know, we had talked about this a little when we were watching it, but it's like, how big is this hospital? There's just like, it's almost becomes like Shining-esque in terms of like,
yes,
you know, this hospital, because it's like you had said, it's off mic. It's like, it's a creepy hospital in a sense, because like there's no one there. It's dark.
It's dark.
They got some
It's the exact opposite of what a hospital should be. Brightly lit, people running around everywhere, no matter what time of night it is, what time of day, whatever. It's patients everywhere. This one is like, I think you nailed it. It's like the Overlook, but if it was a hospital.
Yeah, the number of rooms that they actually go into, it kind of like creates like a labyrinth of like,
yeah,
you know, and it makes Michael's journey through the hospital more interesting, because it's like you have already been here for so long, you've seen like how mazy it is and everything like that. It's like, yeah, Michael could be stalking the halls.
I don't know. I was thinking about that, and it's a big logic problem. So you have this big... It's one of those things where you kind of track Michael's movements and who he kills. It makes you wonder, like, well, wait a minute. If he killed that person, that would have meant that he was near Laurie's room. It's like, it's kind of a thing where it's like, okay, so Michael's point of view, it's like, you walk... If I'm Michael Myers, I walk into this hospital. It's like the Overlook Hotel. It's empty. It's like, maybe I would go to the areas where lights are on and where there are clearly people. Like, because I'm guessing... I mean, who knows what's going through Michael Myers' head, but I would assume that he could reason that Laurie is probably going to be the place where other people are. So, like, are we supposed to believe that Michael, like, just goes through every single door in this hospital? Looking, like, all 500 doors that are probably in this hospital or more?
I don't know about
because
that.
Because there are scenes in this movie where, like, certain people he kills, I'm like, that person was in the same area, the same, like, floor, what have you, as Laurie. So it's like, wouldn't it make more sense for Michael just to go to populated areas?
Well, I think he was.
But he doesn't stick around. It's like he kills some people, goes to somewhere else, and then he comes back. Like, just trying to plot Michael's progression through this hospital, it's like zigzaggy. For instance, he kills, you see him like on the security camera. He's like going around the back. He's gonna cut the phone lines, or whatever. And then later he goes and you see him in the baby room, like where the terrible nurse comes. She's late and she's supposed to be taking care of these children, but she's late. And you see Michael in the back and he walks around. That happens before he goes and kills the security guard. So that means that Michael went into the hospital and then for some reason went back outside to kill the security guard. It's like, I feel like John Madden, like on a whiteboard, like with a marker, like tracking Michael's like movement through this hospital. It's all over the place.
But don't you see? That's what makes the hospital so mysterious. Is that the movement is part of the.
So wait a minute. You're saying that this hospital is so labyrinthy that he goes. He goes into the hospital, sees, like, the babies, and then he goes through a door, and then suddenly he's outside again, and he's like, well, the security guard's here. I guess I'll just kill him while I'm here.
It's basically a more sophisticated version of Scooby-Doo. that's what I think is going on here.
This hospital is interesting because it is definitely the thing that I think this movie is most memorable for is the hospital setting. It's a very creepy hospital. It's like a haunted hospital. It's like, what kind of, it's so unique, and it's such a movie. It's honestly, it made me afraid of hospitals as a kid until I actually went into a hospital, like, you know, however many times or whatever. And then I realized, oh, this is that's a movie hospital. This is not at all what a real hospital is like. Because if you've ever been inside a hospital, it is the brightest lit place you could possibly be. There are people everywhere, but this is like some weird haunted movie hospital. And it's like, it's funny. It simultaneously makes the movie creepy. It has a good atmosphere of this haunted overlook like hospital, but at the same time, it creates so many logic issues with the movie. Like, where are all the patients? Like, why is there one room that has a bunch of kids, but there's like no one there treating them?
Yeah. So that is the one thing that I guess I found myself asking when we were watching is like, well, what? There's like no staff.
Oh my God. Speaking of the kids, I just had a realization. How many kids died when the hospital exploded? Oh, well, wait, I guess it was just that one room though. The whole hospital didn't explode. Okay. But they don't mention those kids. Like, did they get the kids out?
That is something that happens that's like creepy, that there's this. What is it called? A nativity ward or like?
Yes. Then the kids are just like in those like, you know, little buckets or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever,
so you have a bunch of babies them. And then Michael wandering around near the babies. Like it's just creepy.
It's like, are the parents just like, all right, well, we'll come back in a few days to check out our kid. Like, no.
Well, presumably like the parents where the mom is. In another operating room or whatever.
You would think, but all the lights are off. There's Halloween decorations everywhere. Like this, when you go into this room, the light's off. And it's just like, the lights are off pretty much everywhere, except a few hallways. So it's like, where is everybody?
Yeah.
And also, there appears to only be one doctor on staff right now, and he's drunk off his ass.
And then he has like a private like office that's some like, it looks like a library.
Yeah, that's creepily lit with this aquarium.
So, I mean, the hospital is just creepy.
It is.
I didn't find myself distracted by I don't know. It all works. It pretty much works for me.
Well, once again, for me, from my perspective, I've seen this movie a billion times. So I'm looking at different things now. You know what I mean? When you've rewatched the movie so many times, you start to look in the corners and stuff like that of stuff maybe you never noticed. And it's like, this hospital just doesn't make sense. It is the Overlook Hospital.
It's creepy. And I think it adds to it makes the characters more believable in some sense, at least the characters that die, like all the hospital workers, because most of them are like kind of shitty. So it almost makes it like more believable that these people would be working there because they're not. There's like no. There's one nurse. I guess she seems like she's responsible. Like she's the one, the other nurse's boss or whatever. But she doesn't really get an on screen death.
Yeah. But for she some gets reason, an off screen death where I guess Michael drains her of all her blood somehow.
Oh, yeah. Oh man, that scene is so cool. I think that's my favorite scene in the entire movie. When the ambulance driver kid, he walks in and he sees the older nurse's dead body. Like the lighting in that scene in that room, it's like
It was like a Dario Argento movie or something.
Yeah, it was. It was like she's like under a spotlight, basically. And then
the blood is like paint red.
Yeah, the blood is like crimson paint red. But the lighting in that scene is so perfect. It's like, it almost feels like another movie, honestly. Because he walks in this room, and the room, because of the lighting, is so strange and unlike everything else in the rest of the hospital. It's like, where is this? It both takes me out of the movie, but sucks me even deeper. Love that scene.
It's the same scene when one of the nurses finds Dr. Mixture, like, in his room, like, you see the syringe in his eyeball, and the room's only lit by kind of like this green aquarium.
Yeah.
And they do the same thing, the same bit that they did in the first movie, where, like, someone backs up, and it's just darkness behind him, and then slowly, like, Michael's mask is illuminated, like behind their shoulder or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the same trick, but here I feel like it's somehow weirdly even creepier, because, like, it's like a green look to it, and it's so unsettling, like, it's so unnatural looking.
Yeah. So that's one thing that it does stand out to me, is there's a little bit more emphasis on color in
yes.
the second one, even as much as, like, you know, I think the fire, like, the use of fire in this one ties into the use of color too, just that kind of dynamic visual essence, so to speak, because, like, you just, I don't know, color for some reason is, it's not like overbearing or anything like that, but it's a couple moments where they definitely use it, like, manipulate it to kind of come at us.
Yeah, and not only just the color, like, again, I mentioned, like, it has the same DNA as the first movie. Like, I love this, again, we mentioned before in the last episode, where, like, he really does a good job of I should say Dean Cundey, but you got to give credit to the director as well, Rick Rosenthal. But, like, they really use the entire frame. Like, I love that shot in the beginning when Michael, like, when he walks into, like, those old, I can't remember the name of the old couple, but he walks into the house and steals the knife, and you just see them, like, in focus, like, in the foreground, and then him in the background also in focus as he just sort of takes the knife and just sort of, like, sneaks out. You know what I mean? Like, I love that they use the entire frame. That's one of the things I like most about these first two Halloween movies. It kind of seems to sort of go away with from Halloween 4 on. But, like, in the first two movies, like, they really do a good job of using, like, the entire frame to their benefit.
Yeah, definitely. It's very they capitalize on pretty much a lot of stuff that's on screen. But I do think that there is some... So, there's something that this movie does that I think is more in line with the horror franchises of the day, and that's the death of the nurse in the spa or whatever.
So the token big boobed character.
Yeah, so when they introduce her character, and especially her death scene when she's naked and all that stuff, it definitely, like, I don't know how I would describe it, but there's a distinct difference between, like, the shower death in Psycho versus this death in Halloween.
Well,
2.
It's very much like, you got to see her boobs. Like, you could just, I hear, like, a studio executive somewhere, and we should point out this movie was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, who was kind of like a notorious producer of the time. But, like, I could just imagine, like, a studio executive with, like, a cigar, like, yeah, I want to see some more titties. Like, and when he pulls her out, make sure you get a full, like, shot of her boobs. You know what I mean? Like, it feels more exploitative a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
whereas
definitely.
In the first movie, you don't really see a lot of nudity.
Well, the closest you get to that, I think, in the first scene is the scene that I kind of had a problem with, is when the girl gets undressed and she gets caught in the window. Like, that's the closest that the first one, I think, gets to something like this. But this one is very much like this is a scene that you're supposed to remember in the second one. And yeah, it's just like, I think the actual death is pretty brutal. Like, cause
it's horrific.
Yeah.
He melts her face off.
Yeah. So it's pretty brutal. And, some of these deaths are pretty brutal in the second one. But nonetheless, like, I just think that kind of, I don't know, attitude about kills is a little bit more in line with what we started seeing a lot of in the 80s.
Well, like I said, this took place in the heyday of slasher films. It came out a year after Friday the 13th. It would have been the same year, I think, as Friday the 13th Part 2. So suddenly it's like, I go back to the studio exec guy, probably like, it's all about the gore, it's all about the kills, and it's all about the tits. You know what I mean? I feel like I kind of waited to like Columbo there for a second, and I want to take that back because Columbo is a good man. But anyway, like,
one more thing. Just, where's the titties?
Yeah, one more thing. But yeah, it definitely feels like this movie is like, you know, kind of feeling the influence of Friday the 13th. And it's like, I got to imagine that the consensus was, it's like, well, we got to keep up, you know, with all the other ones, because that's what the kids like, you know, that's what they expect. And this movie kind of has like, it kind of walks an interesting line, because like we said before, the DNA of the first movie is here. And I feel like there are often times in this movie where it does feel like the tension that they're setting up and that the longness of the shots that you sit in these moments is still there. But then it also has these moments like with the nurse in the spa room or whatever, where it's just like, it feels blatant nudity just for nudity's sake. And it's like, it kind of walks it goes into both of those worlds a little bit, this movie.
Yeah. And I think, I think for me, in my opinion, it definitely suffers for that reason. I mean, it doesn't ruin the movie, but it just makes it a little bit, the movie feels a little confused, I guess, because there's a good chunk of this movie. And I think it's the reason why I like it so much is because it does feel like very much in the spirit of the first one and respects that origin, that it has. And I don't think like, I don't have a pro. So we didn't even really mention this, but the second one is basically about why Michael Myers,
that's right,
going on this journey and killing people and who Laurie really is. And, it makes sense that this would be the story of the sequel. And I think it handles it relatively well.
Well, it's kind of just like, she's his sister, so of course he'd want to kill her. You know what I mean?
But I think the reason I appreciate it is because it almost like it doesn't worry about creating this big drama of like, who is Laurie? Like it's almost like, oh, this is Laurie. And then it's more about Michael's, you know, quest to get her. I don't know. It just feels like it's more focused because it doesn't worry about the details. Like, okay, yeah, this is who Laurie is, but this is not like, I don't know. It's not distracting to me.
This thing, yeah, it's really weird. Like there was a couple of details I picked up on in this movie, watching it again, where, cause I think for the longest time there was like a question, like why would, like, what's the deal with, like, Michael's parents? And, like, you know what I mean? And how did she... And so they say in the movie that, like, Michael's parents and, I guess, Laurie's parents died 2 years after she was born. So he never met her. It was after... Like, she was born after he was committed. But they died, and I guess she went up for adoption with the Strodes or whatever. But it's like, it's this questions I've had with this movie. Like, there's a scene when Laurie has, like, a dream. Yeah. And it's like her in the institution and Michael's in there and he just sort of looks at her like, I hate you. You know what I mean? But like that couldn't have, like, as a kid, I was always just like, wait a minute, did she know that she was like Michael's sister? But she couldn't have. It was just like it wasn't a memory she was having. It was a dream because like I said, like he was committed before she was born. Like she was born 2 years after he was committed, I think they say. So she never met him. She never knew. And they say that they wanted to protect her, like, don't tell her that, you know. But it's like, she has these weird dreams where she's like, are you my real mother or something? And how does it go? Like,
why won't you ever tell me anything?
I told you. I'm not your mother.
Hey, stop it. I'm not your real mother. You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's funny. Like these are the dreams that Jamie is having. Like she instantly has like these crazy dreams where her foster parents, I guess, hated her. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't remember like that moment of like where the parents didn't like her or anything like that, but
it's just in this dream. And I got to imagine that's not real. She's just like, maybe her mind's putting these things together, but hold on. That doesn't make sense. She doesn't know that she's in that moment. It's not revealed. As far as I know, in the entire movie, she doesn't know that that Michael Myers is her brother. Like only Loomis finds that out. She doesn't know that. The only thing she discovers is that the person that was trying to kill her was Michael Myers, but that's it. So it makes no sense that she starts having these dreams of seeing Michael in the sanitarium and her mother for some reason saying, I'm not your real mother.
Wrong.
It's like, it makes no sense.
Wrong. It makes perfect sense. And that's because of something that you were bothered by in the first one. And that's the power of fate.
Oh, geez.
So if you remember, Dave, the teacher was
fate
lecturing about
catches fate. Up with all of us.
You cannot escape fate. And so there is something going on in the Halloween universe, at least within the first two movies, that's something akin to force movements and trajectories and stuff like that. And so these dreams / visions that Laurie is having is that pull that draws Michael to her.
I hate to burst your bubble, Nick, but John Carpenter has said that the whole way that he came up with this whole storyline of them being brother sister, he came to that conclusion. He had that breakthrough after, as he put it, several six packs of beer. I think John Carpenter has made no bones about the fact that he didn't want to make a Halloween sequel. It sounded like it was some sort of I don't know if it was a contractual thing or if it was something where it's I want to be somewhat involved. I don't want them to screw it up type thing. I'm not sure. But he has said many times that they struggled with the script for this movie because he very much wanted he wanted the ending of the first movie to just be more just sinister and Michael could be anywhere and there is no motive. But it sounded like he struggled with coming up with the motive. It was she's a sister. I don't freaking know.
Well, my version's better.
I like your version. It justifies it. It makes sense bringing it back to that whole overblown out fate discussion that she had the day before in class. But anyway, as far as other beats in this movie, we mentioned in the last episode that this is the one where Donald Pleasance truly goes insane. And it's I feel like the movie shifts because I feel like it almost has to. Because I feel like Donald Pleasance can't be the same somewhat reserved character that he was in the first movie. This movie, they got to ratchet it up. He's got to be crazy. Because I don't think the movie would work as well if he wasn't going evil, evil, as he is in this movie. Because he straight out flips out in this movie.
Well, it makes sense, too, as I think about it. Because in the first movie, no one has technically died in the town yet. So he's still he doesn't have a – he has reason to not be freaked out in a sense. But
– it's more just the dread of what could happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, at the point of the second movie, now three teens
all
are dead.
All hell is broken loose. Yeah, yeah.
The city is on fire. so it's
my worst fears are being realized, Lieutenant.
And in the same sense, the first one, people are still not on board with him. The sheriff is okay, mm-hmm. I'll go along with it, but I'm not I don't really think nothing's happening. You're wrong or whatever, but I'll believe you just to be safe. And then this second one, you have the secondary sheriff or the replacement. And he's all on board at that point. So everybody's kind of realizing that this is a real thing now because three teens are dead.
Mm-hmm. And the body count increases with this one. You got to have better, bigger body count. And it's interesting, speaking of the body count, supposedly this scene with Michael Myers in the beginning when he kills this random girl that he just happens to walk by, that was at the insistence of Carpenter, who I guess the studio exec is hey man, it's 1981, Friday the 13th is a thing now, slasher genre is a thing, we gotta up the kill count in this movie. Can't he just kill some random girl?
Oh god. Who is it? Who is it?
So I think, if I'm not mistaken, that scene was kind of added in, to up the body count.
Huh.
Because it doesn't it feel a little weird? It's almost he I get that he gets the knife from the old people when he goes out on his killing spree again, but it just seems odd that he just oh, there's a girl in my path. Let me watch her a little bit. It's almost as if Michael, after having been shot six times, has to recharge his evil meter. He's I gotta kill a few people and peep on them to get my powers back. Yeah. It's so, especially the way he kills her. He like jumps up from the couch, which is a little uncharacteristic of Michael, and it just knifes her and all this blood comes out. It's just like, it really does feel like he's like, I got to get a few kills under my belt so I can feel good about myself again.
Yeah, his little health meter goes back up once he kills.
Yeah, he well, because like, you know, he did leak some blood out. Like Loomis puts his hand in the grass, he pulls it up, and there's like blood everywhere. So like, you know, his power meter went down when he got shot 6 times. He had to recharge. That's kind of how I view it, a little bit, honestly.
This sounds like basically a Halloween video game.
Yeah, you got to do a little bit of light stalking to get your power charged up a bit. Oh, one thing I should point out, you brought something up while we were watching Halloween 2, specifically about Michael's mask in this one.
Yeah, so it did look different to me.
So there's an interesting story behind that. So the mask that you see in Halloween 2 is actually the exact same mask from the first movie. The problem is... When they were making that first movie, it was a super low budget thing. I doubt any of them thought it was going to become what it became, you know, one of the highest grossing independent films ever made. I don't think we pointed that out. The first Halloween was a huge hit. It took a little bit to get going. I think it got like a good review by someone, and it kind of had like a, like it had been out for maybe like, I don't know, a couple weeks or something. And it took a minute for it to really catch on. But once it did, it made a ton of money. And so, but again, I don't think they were, when they were making that, they didn't think that it would have the success it did. So it's not like they really took care of the mask when they were shooting the movie. Like when you go into the trivia, apparently the actor who played Michael Myers, primarily Nick Castle, he would like roll up the mask and put it like in his back pocket while they were shooting. And I guess after the film completed, one of the writers, Deborah Hill, she kept the mask like under her bed for years before they started doing Halloween 2, and as such it collected dust. It also, I thought this is hilarious, it became yellow because Deborah Hill was like a chain smoker, so the mask took on like this yellow tint to it. And the even funnier thing is, so it's the same mask as before, but the guy playing Michael Myers in Halloween 2 is a different guy, Dick Warlock. He is like stockier than Nick Castle, so when you put the mask on it, I don't know if you noticed it, but like it looks like tight around his face.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he struggled to get it on. So it's the same mask, but it's had a little wear and tear.
That's so funny and random that she would keep it under her bed for years.
Well, it's like a thing. And it's funny too, because like they gave this movie ends. And when this movie ends, like I think at the time they were like, all right, this is putting the end to Michael Myers. Like we burned him up. He's dead. When we do Halloween 3, we're going to change gears. And it's going to be like an anthology thing almost, like where each movie's different. So they didn't think Michael Myers was going to come back. So the producers of the movie let Dick Warlock keep the mask. In fact, they let him keep the mask, the scalpel, the boots, the jumpsuit, and the knife that they used, which I think is kind of interesting. That's pretty cool for Dick Warlock. But yeah, it's kind of funny when you get these low budget movies that end up becoming big. And like I guess that kind of became a thing afterwards, where they're like, all right, we can't give out props to the cast because we might do a sequel down the road.
Yeah, you know.
But I think that's like the first bit of trivia in the Chad DB, and it's probably like the most interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, because it definitely looks, I mean, it looked different, and knowing the story now is like, yeah, that does look dirty,
like a dirty road tear version of the first mask.
Yeah, but that's interesting, and it does. I was thinking that it looked different too, and what you said about the face, the way it, you know, fits.
It just stretches on his face more.
Yeah. So, and another thing we had talked about, I think it's worth mentioning again, but we had mentioned the difference in movements between Michael Myers in the first one and the second one. And we had said that, or you specifically had said that he seems to like more like glide in the first one. And I think you're right. And I think that this one, I don't know for sure because we didn't excuse me, I didn't like clock it or anything like that, but it seems like we see him in motion, actually like taking physical steps more in this one. And I think that makes sense because he's walking in the hospital and stuff like that. Yeah. Whereas in the first one, his appearance is kind of, he appears and kills. And I mean, that does happen in the second one, but I think we see him moving. Like we even see him, if I remember correctly, like walking in the street in the second mm-hmm. one, like when he's, you know, he runs into that guy with boombox.
Like the problem is like he's so stiff and like I can't imagine this. It's like I imagine this Michael Myers has a problem like putting his arms up over his head, you know what I mean? Like he's very much like he has like a RoboCop like walk where his hands are always at his sides and he's just walking very, you know, robotically. And to the point where I can't imagine this Michael Myers. There's a scene when he's chasing Laurie and she like jumps up through a window that's high up and, you know, she gets in another room. And then later you see Michael, it just cuts and he's in the room. It's like, I wanted to see this Michael Myers, this robot version of Michael Myers, like trying to crawl up that window and like fall down into the room. It's like, I can't imagine it because he just doesn't have the movement that would require that, you know, that would be needed for him to make that movement.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, it's so much so where, like, there's a scene when he's chasing her and he's walking down the staircase. And, like, normally when you walk down the stairs, your head's down, you're looking at the steps, like, you know, as you descend. But his face is straight up. He's looking straight across as he's walking down. You know what I mean? His head isn't looking down. And it's such a bizarre thing. It makes him feel more like a Terminator than anything.
Well, it's interesting because to me, it almost feels like the Michael Myers' entity and his portrayal actually feels like more old school in the second one because of his movements. Because I think in my mind, a lot of like old school horror, like Frankenstein and Night of the Living Dead and stuff like that, those monsters typically moved slower. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. It's almost like they were trying to return to form or something like that. At least that's the way it seems. And so
it's worth noting they show Night of the Living Dead on the TV.
That's true. Yeah, they do. And so I feel like that might have been intentional where they're like, okay, let's go older and that was creepier back then. And I think, you know, it does have an effect, but I think like we've talked about his presence is so much more palpable in the first one. And I think it's like it to contrast them, there's Michael feels like it almost feels like Michael's hunting in the second one as opposed to the first one. He's also hunting, but he's, I don't know how to describe it. Like he's
feels
like,
more like elemental in the first movie.
So I think that's what I was trying to get at is like, I think his name in the first one, the shape is so apropos and it's just, it perfectly encapsulates who or what he is in the first one versus the second one.
Well, because and I think it goes back to like giving him motivation, like because like you said, in this one, it's like he's hunting, like he has more of a purpose. Whereas in the first movie, it's just like it gets into what you mentioned about the strangers. Like it feels more like you were home. You know what I mean? Like it has that energy to it in the first one.
I mean, because actually, if you think, I think we're biased in a sense because we know that the second one exists and Michael Myers has this motivation. But really, if you try to put yourself back in 1978 when the first one came out, I mean, there you may not even wonder why Laurie is it wrapped up in this. So it's almost like Michael Myers is just this. I just have this analogy in my head of like a big fog moving through the town, and it's just like slowly killing people, and like that's kind of how I feel about Michael Myers in the first one.
Well, it's like really the only motivation was, if any, is like he was in his house. He went back to his house. And she happened to show up. She dropped a key off and like he saw her. And then it's basically from then on, it's like, I'm just going to follow this girl. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of all it was as far as motivation. He's like, she just happened to drop off a key. He's like, I'm going to follow her around.
Yeah. And the second one is very much like he's on a mission, right? It's more clear, at least what he's trying to do.
It gives it a different energy, especially at the end when he full on just walks through that plate glass window.
Oh yeah.
Or he walks through the door or whatever. Like again, it feels more like the Terminator or something. And I love that moment, and it's a shocking moment. It's like, whoa. But at the same time, again, it's like it's a completely different type of energy than the first movie. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's like grandiose, and I get it. It's a sequel. They want to go big. Like, he just walked through the window, man, or the door. And it's just, again, I like this movie. I don't want to make it sound like I don't. I really enjoy this movie, but I like it for the things that it does, but it's like, it is absolutely like a different like vibe than the first movie.
It definitely has a, it's, this, I don't know if this makes sense, but it's less serious than the first
one. It's a little goofy, you know, especially with the death of Ben Tramer. We didn't talk about the first movie. Like, Ben Tramer, his name is dropped in the first one. Like, Annie's like, yeah, I got you a date with Ben Tramer. And it's this back and forth. Like, I want you to call him back and call it off. Like, I'm too embarrassed. And then we find out that Ben Tramer just had a night of, like, drinking. And he wore the same mask that Michael Myers has, only, like, a gold version, I guess. I don't know if you picked up on this, but it looked like his hair was, like, golden and, like, puffed out.
This is the kid who dies in the fire?
Yeah, the kid who gets run over by the cop, played by Dick Warlock, by the way. That's Ben Tramer. Oh. He was the guy where the two kids are like, hey, our friend Ben Tramer, lad, he walked out like, you know, he was really drunk. And, it's like, and then Dick Warlock, who's playing this cop, like, who's driving apparently like 80 miles an hour down this, like, you know, residential street, just like nails him. And then we get like an explosion. It's like, it's a cool moment. But again, it's like this is like the, you know, like the big trappings of a sequel. It's like, it's got to be bigger and better, so therefore we got to have explosions. And it's like, it does shift from like the spookiness of the first movie to almost like kind of like action-y a little bit for part two.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's certainly a number of moments that are like that are less atmosphere and more more action,
more shock, like, whoa.
Yeah, did you see that?
But it's such a funny moment. And like this, and again, I mentioned before, like, this is the movie where Loomis truly goes insane. Like, I love the part where he's like loading his gun, and he's got his gun, like, he's waving it around in like Sheriff Brackett's face, and Sheriff Brackett's like, but you put that away, man, you're gonna shoot me. And just like, one of the funniest scenes of the movie is when like Loomis is frantically looking around, and he sees like who we find out is Ben Tramer. He's like, stop the car. He's like, you can't you get out of the way? And he, like, I'm surprised he's not shooting wildly in the air at this point. And this is the point where Loomis is like, okay, like, I think the governor is right, Loomis. You need to go home. Because this Loomis is completely off the wall here. Like, I'm surprised. Like, he's waving this gun around. All these kids are like, oh my God. And rightfully so, Sheriff Rackett's just like, Loomis, stop, you idiot. You maniac.
Get back. Run! Go on, run! Loomis! Get back! Get back, you pig! Run! Loomis! Stop! Get out of here!
Loomis! Stop! 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 Move! It's just like, again, like... It just ratchets everything up, and this is the portrayal of Donald Pleasance. It happens in this movie where it's like popularly, like, everyone thinks of Loomis as this crazy madman, and it starts in this movie.
This is where he lost it.
Well, again, it's like they had to shift the character. It's like, we can't have him be just the same resigned guy. He's got to be wild and crazy. It's just like,
what is it you fellas usually do? Fire a warning shot, right?
Oh, that reminds me. Okay. So one scene I always had kind of a problem with in this movie, it's the scene in the school when they're like, there's a break-in at the school, we're pretty sure it's him. And they see that Michael has like stabbed this knife into a table, like a drawing of like a family. And he's written down what looks like in blood on the chalkboard, Samhain, or as Donald Pleasance says, Samhain. And like, even as a kid, like, I always thought this seemed out of place. Like, as a kid, honestly, I'm like, this wasn't Michael that did this. This was someone else. Because, like, it just didn't seem like something Michael would do.
I mean,
it seems like, I mean, like, I guess I shouldn't say
you
that.
You think there's a copycat, Michael, Dave?
Michael went to the trouble of, like, grabbing that headstone and putting it. So Michael's not above, like, you know, doing crazy stuff, but, you know, to pose like a death scene or what have you. That was established in the first movie. But it always just seemed odd that he would go into a school and stab a picture of like a family and then like write in blood, I don't know whose blood, Samhain. It's like, it seemed off to me. It seemed like, I'm like, why was this in the movie?
Well, that, it's not a W, Dave. It is a M. Samhain.
Well, I know, but you say it like Samhain. I didn't find this out for years. I was pronouncing it wrong. Cody had to correct me once. It's like, no, it's pronounced Samhain. It's not Samhain. Donald Pleasance is mispronouncing it, and no one bothered to correct him.
No, it's a Celtic word. Samhain.
I know it is an M in there, but you're supposed to say it like Samhain.
Oh.
But the weird thing about it is, it's like Donald Pleasance starts talking about like, oh, you know, the druids would make sacrifices, and it would allow them to see the elements of the future. And it's like, again, it gets into the bits like, so now Michael not only wants, there's a brother and sister connection, but now they're bringing in witchcraft and all this stuff. Like, it just seems out of left field, and it's not really referenced again.
Yeah.
Like, as far as Michael's motivation, and it always felt out of place to me.
No, I think you're right. I mean, in retrospect, it does. If this movie wasn't so short, like, this is, I think this is a misstep that a modern movie would make or has made, is just, you know, that kind of bloating that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Oftentimes in more modern movies, and like this movie, because it's, you know, 90 something minutes, that it almost like, it doesn't linger on something that's goofy or out of place. Like, you kind of get to forget about it right away, mm-hmm. but you're absolutely right. Like, it does. It's like this introduction of this weird stuff that doesn't make sense compared to what you just saw. And I mean, granted, we watched these back to back. So to be fair as well, this movie is supposed to be taking place in the same night. So yeah. It's just like, why these sudden turns?
Yeah. And again, it's just like, it's a sequel. It's got to be bigger, better. We got to like throw in motivation. But it's just like, honestly, I think it would have been enough that they were brother and sister, and that's why he's killing her. But they throw in this Samhain thing of like ancient druids and whatnot, like to sort of explain Michael's like, so is Michael trying to kill his family so he could see the future? Is that what Loomis is saying? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's goofy. It's almost like was this foreshadowing to the next movie? Like, hey, the next movie is gonna have witchcraft in it.
Well, I mean, that's what I was wondering.
Was it kind of like a nod to what they were gonna do in the next movie, which only came out a year later?
Yeah, so that's what I thought, but that's only because we have the gift of foresight here.
Well, we did some sacrifices and we were able to see elements of the future.
Yeah, we sacrificed Mike.
Several times.
And we saw the future, and there's Halloween 3. But yeah, that's what I was wondering or thinking about when they mentioned that. I'm like, okay, they're planting the seeds for future endeavors that are, maybe they already know what they're planning. So you know, really preceding the MCU in terms of planning.
Because that's the only thing that makes sense, right? Knowing the movie that would follow this one, which was all about witchcraft and all that stuff and druids and this and that. It's like, and maybe that's just Carpenter's way of like making a quick nod to the movie that's going to follow this one. Maybe that's the only thing that makes somewhat kind of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, it's like, what, otherwise why? Because it's not really addressed ever again.
No, he talks about it in the car. That he's like, oh, so, like when she's like, so what's the deal with that knife and the Samhain thing? He's like, oh, well, first of all, let me correct you. It's Samhain. That's how you pronounce it. That's how I pronounce it. But and you see the cop like looking like the marshal, like, what the hell is this guy talking about? It's like, again, it's so bizarre. It doesn't come back into the movie at all. And The only justification could possibly be that I could think of is that it's just a nod to the next movie, but that's the only thing that makes any sense.
Or, I mean, alternatively, that if we don't give them the benefit of the doubt, they just wanted to add to the evil factor.
And, I guess.
You know, witchcraft and sacrifice is all very evil.
But then that gets into like, so wait, was like, how was Michael as a kid like into witchcraft? You know what I mean?
Well, you know what's funny? Actually, it's so funny that you say that. I remember when we were watching it and he was explaining what that was, Dr. Loomis, when he was explaining it, I was like, okay, so how did Michael learn about that?
Exactly. Did he learn about it in the institution? Like, was this after he killed his sister? It's like, it leads to questions that the filmmakers don't have. And that when you stop to think about, make no sense.
Well, I think the real story here, and you know, as we've been talking about both last episode and this episode, this is kind of a retrospective on Loomis. I think the truth of the matter was that Loomis was grooming Michael.
Oh, my God.
And Loomis taught Michael about Samhain. And so, but now that Michael is out, Loomis has lost control of his creation. And that's why Michael walks closer to, in line with Frankenstein. It's Frankenstein's monster in the second one, because that transformation of loose creation has gone further.
Like, maybe the first 7 years he did try to really get through to Michael, couldn't, and then eventually he's like, I give up. And then he has to go see him on these days because he's his doctor, and then he's like, oh, hell, Michael, maybe you want to look into the Samhain stuff I'm looking at. Like, I'm just sort of interested. It's a hobby that I do on the side. Like, I don't know why I bother talking to you anymore, so I'm just going to read my Samhain book. You know, it's...
No. I see. I think it's even more sinister than that. That Loomis from the beginning had tried to breed and groom Michael to be his vessel.
It's interesting you point that out. That something similar might come up in a future Halloween sequel.
Oh, see. Well, I knew it. See, I'm using the power of Samhain and seeing, you know, the foreshadowing and the having the foresight of future events.
Well, did you have any other talking points you wanted to talk about for Halloween 2?
Not too much. I mean, it's definitely not on par with the first one or anything like that, but it's definitely entertaining. Like, I have a lot of fun watching this. You know, I think because we just got done with Shocktober, and it reminded me of, like, you know, the first Maniac Cop, because you and I watched that together for research. Mm-hmm. And that is also a fun movie, and I think this one's probably a little bit better just in terms of, you know, artistry and stuff like that, but they're both like that kind of very brisk, fun movie that's like a horror slasher.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it's like, we're not going to get to this for a while, but, you know, because we're only going to do like maybe one of these a month. But the David Gordon Green Halloween remakes, where they do that retcon thing of like, we're making a sequel to the first movie and ignoring all the other sequels that came out. Like, I feel like those movies, I lost the thread already. I've lost where I was going with that. Scratch that. We'll just talk about that some other time. Sorry. I immediately lost where I was going with that. Sorry.
Samhain.
Damn you, Samhain! But, no, I guess what I was getting at was, like, you know, those movies, I think that first one is really good, that David Gordon Green one from 2018 is really good, and then it kind of loses the thread immediately after that. But I honestly, like, as far as top-tier Halloween, I would put Halloween 2 in top-tier Halloween, and, you know, as far as, like, the good ones. Like you said, it has an artistry, and there, you know, it has like the DNA of the first movie. And I think you really nailed on the whole idea of like the colors in this movie. Like, visually, I think this movie does some interesting things.
Yeah. So, I mean, so far we only have two. Well, but I have seen the third one. But I think, like, you know, if I would say Halloween is like A, S tier, you know, the top of the top. And then, you know, nothing can probably compare to that. So, like, I don't think Halloween 2 stands shoulder to shoulder with the first one at all. But it's definitely, like, in the upper tiers, like maybe B, C plus or whatever. So, I think that's where I would probably put these. And then we'll find out how I feel about the third one. But,
well, there was one thing, there was two more things I want to mention before we wrap it up. First off, like, one thing, I don't think I ever really paid much attention to this as a kid, but watching it now, it's like more horrifying to me because the ramifications of this. But the whole bit with the kid and his mom coming in because the kid was bobbing for apples and a razor got stuck in his mouth because someone stuck a razor in the apples. Now, this was the thing that was like a big scare, like in the 80s and maybe 90s. You don't hear about this. Well, now, like, nowadays, it's more like fentanyl and candy or something.
Yeah, But
back in the day, the big scare that was probably more of a myth than anything was like razor blades in the apples. And I'm like, just seeing like this kid with this razor sticking out of the roof of his mouth, like, was horrifying to me. Almost more horrifying than anything else in the movie.
It is. I mean, it is. If you think about this happening, like, this is obviously Michael. Well, presumably, I guess not obviously, but presumably Michael did not put the razor.
No.
In the apple.
Yeah.
So you have some other monster wandering around Haddonfield putting razors in apples.
Which is so messed up. And it's like, I, again, speaking to like a, maybe like a meta thing or a nod that Carpenter is doing, but I imagine it's him, like, this was a big scare at the time, so he's referencing it. But again, it's almost a mistake, because then it's like my mind starts to go to like, well, who's doing this in Haddonfield? Like, who is this other monster that's like putting razor blades in kids' mouths?
Yeah, it's actually messed up when you think about it.
It's so messed up.
And it's almost like, so you bring it up, but it's like, now I'm thinking about it, like, it's that kid and whatever happened to him with the razor blade almost puts like a Lynchian twist on Haddonfield. So it's like, there's this yes. like dark underworld in Haddonfield, because like this hollow, this hospital is understaffed and,
it looks haunted.
There's like supposedly nothing ever happens in Haddonfield, but then there's also a kid with a razor blade in his mouth going on.
Yes.
And there are these drunk kids riding around in their cars and stoner vans and, you know,
and molesting children, apparently.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. I mean, so it's just like Haddonfield is a very dark, dark place, I think. And so I need Lynch to make a Halloween movie.
He could make the Samhain movie or the Samhain movie.
It means the Lord of the Dead. The end of summer, the festival of Samhain.
I tell you what, Sheriff, this coffee is damn good. This is some damn good coffee you have here in Haddonfield, Sheriff Brackett. Anyway, speaking of Loomis, that was my last bit that I had. That this isn't, I mean, if you're like, you know, paying attention, you would have noticed this. But for the longest time, I never noticed that the lighter that Loomis uses in the end of the movie was the same lighter that the cop guy gave him earlier in a throwaway scene. Like, they don't call attention to it, really. It's like this cop, like, they're standing outside the Myers house. Like, the whole town's gone crazy. Like, burn it down! You know what I mean? They're going nuts. And, like, this cop is just having a cigarette, and he gives Loomis a cigarette, who just kind of takes it. Like, Loomis is, like, lost in, like, his Van Helsing talk. He's not paying attention. He just sort of takes a cigarette with no intention of smoking it, and then the cop gives him a lighter. And the and Loomis doesn't do anything. He's like, okay, I'll take this lighter. Like, and then he like throws the cigarette on the ground. But I guess he keeps the lighter that the cop gave him, because it's the same lighter he uses to blow up the hospital in the end. And I never noticed that.
Huh.
Well, because it's such a throwaway scene. Like Loomis is talking. He's like, he's evil, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And like the cop is lighting the cigarette, and he kind of absentmindedly gives Loomis the cigarette and the lighter. But I guess Loomis held on to the lighter, and I never noticed that.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. That's pretty cool, actually, though. I mean, that they kept the continuity in that regard. So they cared more about the lighter than the Michael's movements through the hospital.
Well, I never... Well, it never occurred to me, because, like, you know, because Loomis does... You never see him smoking, so it's like... I never had a second thought of why he would have a lighter on him. Like, it's the 70s, early 80s. Like, everyone's smoking. It's just what their people do. But, like, I never realized that he only had that lighter because that cop gave it to him, like, absentmindedly as he was giving him a cigarette.
Huh.
I never made that connection. I just thought that was interesting. Because, again, it's such a small moment, and they don't really call attention to it. Like, you know, you probably, like, I never noticed it for decades that that's how he got that lighter.
I've always wondered.
No, you didn't. Again, this is me watching this movie for the millionth time and picking up on those details that aren't necessarily important. Like I said, like, for the longest time, it never occurred to me why Loomis would have a lighter. I didn't second guess it. He's like, yeah, he's got a lighter. But I just thought it was like a fun little fact, you know. It was like one of those things where it's like Back to the Future, like, it starts off as Twin Pines Mall, then he goes back in time, wrecks the guy's like tree or whatever, and then suddenly he comes back and it's Lone Pine Mall. It's just like those little details that they put in the movie that are kind of nice if you're paying attention.
Well, I mean, the first time I saw Halloween 2, I really hated it because I was like, where did Loomis get this lighter? And, I mean, now I can see.
I'm not saying this is like a cinema sin or something like that. It was just an interesting little thing.
I'm just giving
you
a hard time. No,
I know you are.
I think that's cool. Like, I definitely, to be transparent, I did not notice this lighter incident. So, I'm glad.
Well, it was only because it was also yellow. That kind of helped.
I do like when you mentioned that, I'm like, wasn't it yellow for some reason? So, I mean, again, color. It's all about the color.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that tipped it out. When he holds it up, it's yellow, and I'm like, wait a minute, he was handed a lighter by that cop earlier in the movie. So anyway, a fun little Halloween fact for you all. But I think that's going to do it. Do you have any other thoughts on Halloween Dose?
No.
All right. Well, the next time we see you guys on the Apocalypse Video Halloween Retrospective, we will be taking a visit to Santa Mira, where things are afoot with masks and goblins and witchcraft and warlocks and witches. We'll be back next time with Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
It's Samhain.
Correction, Dr. Loomis. I believe it's pronounced Samhain.
You're evil! Get out of my office!
It is time, Michael.